The Strange Motion Way podcast, brought to you by Royal Purple Synthetic Oils.
Royal Purple premium synthetic motor oils and high-performance chemicals have been designed to improve performance in all conditions and provide cleaner operation, better mileage, and decreased oil change frequency. That means less oil changes. With products available for your gasoline and diesel engines, Royal Purple is the obvious choice for your performance needs. Drive with Royal Purple, the synthetic expert. So welcome to another episode of the Strange Motion Way podcast. I am Tim Strange with my hostess with the mostest here beside me today.
Very strange.
And we are finally getting time to interview one of our good friends. When we started putting this list together, we want to do a podcast, Rob was definitely at the very top of the list to sit down and talk to. So a little lead in here of Mr. Rob Ida. Some of this might be wrong. Some of it might have been made up. I don't know. Third generation car guy. He hit the ground running as a young kid when he built his Willys pickup truck, which he has back. We'll probably talk about that. He's been involved with Willys aftermarket bodies with his dad in the past. Tuckers, both steel and reproduction. He built a Tucker that was only ever on paper. He's done SEMA builds, Ford Design Award, Custom d'Elegance at Sacramento. He's done Land Speed Records, or Land Speed Racing and Records. And to me, they were one of the first shops, him and his dad, that started doing billet one-off fuel injection and billet wheels out of the shop. And this year, we had the honor of helping induct Mr. Rob Ida in the National Rod and Custom Car Hall of Fame as a builder. So welcome, Rob Ida.
Well, thank you. Thank you, guys. And thanks for the nice introduction. Happy to be here and honored that you'd have me on your show.
Yeah, well, glad this is our take two. We were supposed to do it, last week? And you weren't feeling very good.
Right.
So everything worked out. So we're here today. And so let's get a little story about how you grew up and got into cars. I like to go way back as a little grommet, little nugget running around your dad's shop. And of course, I know some of the story about your grandpa, and we'd like to talk about that too. So how'd you get your start as a young kid? Were cars always around your life?
Yeah. So, you know, for me, it was, I didn't go to Little League or anything like that. What I did was I hung out at the family shop, and we grew up on a large piece of property in Jersey. At the time, it was like out in the middle of nowhere. You know, now it's built up and it's kind of, a busy place to be. But when I was growing up, we were like in the middle of the woods. And so my father moved out of the New York City, and he started a repair shop, and it was right on the property that we lived on. And he'd fix cars, you know, normal cars, not hot rods, but he would fix cars, mechanical work and body work and collision work and that kind of stuff. So that was my playground. You know, we had like a little bit of a junkyard on the property where cars would kind of gather and never leave, and we would use them for parts and this and that. And he would, you know, just put up with me hanging around the shop as a little kid because I didn't really have anything else to do. And I would hang out there, and I would learn how to use tools and a spray gun and a welder. And he was pretty patient with me, and, you know, he was encouraging for me to be around. And that's what I did. And it was just always like the thing to do was to hang out in the shop. And so that's kind of how I got my start.
Is that the same location your shop's at now, or are you at a different location?
No, we're in a different location now, but not far. We're only less than a mile away from where that property was. And we built a new shop, I guess, about 25 years ago, so it's not so new anymore. But we built a shop specifically for what we do now. And so that's where we are. Also in the woods, you know, it's kind of hidden in the woods because it's not the type of business that requires traffic or, you know, a retail storefront. So where we are, you wouldn't even find it if you didn't know exactly where to go. You would drive right past us.
Yeah, I've actually never been to your shop. My wife and my mom had been there.
Yeah, yeah.
When you were doing that piggyback tuning system, right. Put one on a SEMA build for us, and they flew out and picked it up and drove it home. And
You weren't far yesterday. You said you were at Maple Grove Raceway.
Yeah, I should. Right. I needed to get back and get to the shop, but I will make a trip out and see you. I've got a few things I need to go on the East Coast. I would say we never take the time. We'd like to just go take a vacation a week and hop around the East Coast and see all the cool museums and tourist stuff out that way. So I know, but your grandpa was also a car person.
Yeah.
And so tell us a little bit about that. That's pretty interesting history of your grandfather.
Yeah, that's kind of really how the Ida family got involved in cars. So he came from Italy, and he wasn't, you know, a car guy, but he was looking for a way to start a business and be able to, you know, kind of make his way here in the U.S. So he heard about Tucker, right? Tucker was like this new way of building a car. It was a rear engine, very stylish, kind of safety minded, performance oriented concept for a vehicle. And he was promoting this car that was not being built by the big three. He was kind of like this, you know, guy who was going to shake things up by starting his own car company. And he was offering franchise dealerships to people that didn't necessarily already have a car dealership. So it wasn't like, you know, you had to qualify for this thing by having some major dealership that's already in motion. You can get in on the ground floor. And so they were signing up even like, you know, gas stations and used car lots and really small companies. People were able to get involved in investing in this new car. And you got to kind of think about Tucker at the time was almost like the Tesla, you know, was, you know, a few years ago, where he's like really doing things differently. And not only is the car different, but the way he's manufacturing it is different, the way he's marketing it, the way he's funding it, all of those things were different than what we were used to seeing by like the big three.
Do you know so what the franchise fee was back then?
I don't.
I think I've seen a picture of a check or something that maybe you had or the Tucker boys had online, but
yeah,
I mean, back then it was a lot of money, but now it seemed like it was not that much to get a franchise with today.
Yeah, yeah, I knew, but I don't remember what it was. But I did post online one time a picture of a refund check that he got like in the 70s. So it took that much time, you know, because the Tucker Corporation ended in 48. And somewhere in the 70s, he got some kind of a refund check through the government. And it wasn't for the full amount, but it was something. So it's possible that that's the check that you saw, but I don't remember what the franchise cost was, but he was in New York City. So with that, he had exposure to more of the cars than some of the other dealerships might have had. And he had a few cars come through there for promotional things.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So it was kind of cool. And with that, he had a really nice storefront, and they loaded the place up with seat covers, radios, ashtrays, things that you would get when you went to the Tucker dealership to put a deposit down. You didn't just give them money and get nothing for your money. He was smart enough where he would take the deposit, but also give you something in return. So it could be luggage or seat covers or radio and things like that. So you'll see a lot of Tucker radios around, you know, like people send me links all the time. Maybe one pops up on eBay. But they're not really all that rare because that was part of the funding exercise that Tucker was going through. It's one of the things that kind of got him caught up in a legal battle, which he won, but the battle kind of cost him his business. You know, going through that meat grinder was the thing that kind of ended the company for him.
Yeah.
So my grandfather, you know, he bought into that. It ended quickly, and then now that he was kind of in the automotive business, he moved over to Brooklyn and he started just a gas station where he bought a gas station. And in that gas station, he had this idea of renting trailers. So like before there was a U-Haul or a Ryder, he was actually fabricating his own trailers in Brooklyn and renting them out to people. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a new concept, and he was doing that. And while he was doing that and they were pumping gas and fixing cars, my father, who was just a young guy at the time, started to build his own race car. So he had a 40 Willys gasser that he was building in that gas station in Brooklyn with a blown 409 in it. And then he went on to build the Hemi Healy, which you're probably aware of. The Hemi Healy is a pretty famous car, and he built that and he raced it, crashed it and scrapped it before I was born. And then after that, he moved to New Jersey into the woods and started fixing cars for a living with, you know, a little bit of hot rod work going on the side, more of a hobby than it was his business. But that was always kind of the thing that, kept me interested in the shop.
So I kind of, been friends with you for a long time, so I kind of know some of your history. But wasn't there some story like you didn't know, like, how much of a hot rod guy your dad was until you found a picture of the old Hemi Healy car?
Yeah. So I was seven. And at the time when he moved from the city to the country, he kind of got out of hot rods and he got into horses. So he met a bunch of guys locally that were into horses, and he started to kind of go down that path. So
horses expensive.
Yeah. He had horses on the property. We had cows and chickens. It was like a regular farm. And so I was kind of, following whatever he was doing, I was doing, because I was, tagging along. And so I had some interest in that. But then one day when I was 7 years old, I found his old scrapbook with a picture of his old gassers in it and his hot rods and the Hemi Healy standing on its rear bumper. And when I saw that, I lost all my interest in horses and farm life. And I was like, no, we need hot rods. Like, this is what we got to do.
Why were you snooping around in your dad's stuff? I was probably that age when I found my dad's Playboy stash.
Well, he was probably, wanting me to see it. Yeah. So I saw it, and I just remember seeing the picture of that car standing on its rear bumper. And I was like, what is this? This is the coolest thing I ever saw. And after that, I was just totally fixated on hot rods and gassers.
We might bounce around in the timeline a little bit. But
yeah.
That car, you later, way later, but not too long ago in today's standards, you recreated that car, did you?
Yeah, so like 10 years ago, a car popped up on eBay, and Sean Tucker, so he's the great grandson of Preston Tucker, he sent me a link on eBay, and he goes, man, this car really looks like the Hemi Healy. And so it was out in the Midwest, and it was painted black, but it had certain things about it that really looked like the Hemi Healy. And the it's a two-seater, which is a little bit rare for that car. It was a two-seater, and rear wheel openings were cut wide open for gigantic slicks, and it still had the same front wheels on it. So I bought the car for my father as his 70th birthday, and I figured we'll recreate, the Hemi Healy for him. And so it turns out it was actually the car. Like, the car was saved, and, he sent it to a scrapper. He sent it to the junkyard. We assumed it got crushed and was gone, but it turns out someone saved it for whatever reason.
I guess I didn't realize it was actually the same car.
Yeah, it's the same car. Yeah. And so we bought it not thinking that it was the same car. We didn't know that until we, uncovered some paint and some things that he remembers.
He sent that to the scrapper.
Yeah, so he stood it up on the rear bumper, and when it came crashing down, it just, bent in half, and he said, okay, that's the end of this car. He said it was way too violent to drive anyway. It was not really his best race car. So took all the...
So that was missing for over 50 years.
Yeah, it was gone. Yep. So we never even thought to look for it, just assumed it was crushed and gone and junk.
My dad recently found a 55 Chevy that he got rid of in, 1984 or 5.
Yeah.
It's still got the same paint on, and he's trying to buy it back. So it's kind of cool when you find, we're car people, so the cars are part of the family. It's like, oh, wow.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, oh, that's awesome. So he knows where it is, and he has to convince someone to sell it back to him?
Well, actually, I've seen a post on a car show page on Facebook. So then I started asking around about it.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, oh, it was at this show. So I shared it, and that's... social media is not all good, but this was the good part of social media.
Yeah.
Like, almost 1,000 people shared it. So it went all over the place. And then within a week, people start giving me the guy's phone number and his dad's number. And so my dad talked to him, and my dad went up last fall in Wisconsin, seen it, visited with him. And this, at the end of this year, they might want to sell it. So they're going to give him first chance to buy it back.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Nice. Is it the same, or has it been changed?
We painted that thing, I was 8 years old when he built that car, and it was yellow, and I grabbed the gun, squeezed the trigger, and freaked out and didn't move, and the car had a tilt front end, so I had this big run on the firewall, and he left that there.
Oh, wow.
It's still on the firewall.
Wow, that's cool.
Painted with DuPont Centauri in a two-stall garage, and a really good Midwest owl hull pinstripe flames on it, and all the flames and everything are still on it. The original
cool.
seats, the carpet's been changed. wheels have been changed and it's got a blower motor in instead of a tunnel ramp. But the tunnel, everything, the paint, everything's still the same.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So, yeah. So it's pretty.
I hope you get it back.
I hope he does. But then when people know the history, he found an old 57 Chevy that was his years ago. And then all of a sudden they want 20 grand more than what it's supposed to be worth. So that's probably what's going to happen with his
57. Yeah. I hope that doesn't happen. But yeah, it would be cool to have it back. So my Willys pickup, I got back. And when I was 14, I started building this Willys pickup truck. And it was one of these things, you know, I wanted to do it all on my own. You know, I would get a little advice from my father, but his hands weren't on it. You know, like I did all the work. And I, you know, it was just something I wanted to do. And I learned, you know, pretty much everything I know now, I learned between the ages of 14 and 17, building that truck, building that Willys pickup. But everything I know now is just, you know, refined from that. But, you know, the basic things that I learned doing that, I still do every day, you know. And not only just, you know, about the welding and fabricating and designing and electrical and all that stuff, but also like how to fund it, right? So I had to earn money to build this thing. And so that meant buying a used car for $300 and fixing it up a little bit and selling it for $500 or, you know, whatever you could do to turn a profit so you could buy the next part. And so I learned, you know, I learned business. I learned all the fabricating things that go into a car, learning how to deal with people. You know, when you're 14 years old and 15 years old, trying to buy and sell a car, now you're negotiating and you're talking to people and talking to adults and they're looking down at a little kid, you know, and whether they're going to take me seriously or not, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, well, right. We're always learning. But all of those things from that experience of building that Willys pickup, you know, and having the guidance and the ability to, you know, solve a problem, you know, I still use all those things now, you know, and it's just a more refined version of that. You know, you just kind of stick with it and you try to evolve and you try to improve all the time, but really it's all the same stuff. And so I built that truck between the ages of 14 and 17. And when I was 17 years old, I got my driver's license. And so my wife, Brenda, so we've been married for 26 years and we met 36 years ago. And so I took her on her first date in that Willys pickup and picked her up at her house after school. And we went to the beach and we drove that Willys pickup and it was like the coolest thing, right? And then I drove that for a few years until my next time.
She go out with you? You guys go to the same school?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to hear the story of the family. Brenda's awesome. We did a Caribbean cruise we did for charity with Von Hot Rod and for America's Vet Dogs with the Ida family, and one of his daughters came. Great, 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 great people. So we know Brenda, and she's awesome. And so did she go out with you because of your hot rod and thinking you had money? Because Carrie liked my hot rods thinking I had money. Well, I didn't have money because I had hot rods.
Yeah, right. You had the opposite of money. Yeah.
We went on the pickup truck the week before our actual first date. We kind of knew each other for a long time.
Yeah.
And she almost didn't go with me because my truck was wrecked and I showed up in my mom's Beretta. Mm. So she almost didn't go because I didn't have
really
car to take her out in. So
yeah.
Was Brenda attracted to you because of your good looks, thinking you had money, or your hot rod?
It definitely wasn't because of the hot rod, right? It definitely was not for that. You'll have to ask her why, because still to this day, I can't figure out why, and I can't figure out why.
There's a picture of her. You know, mullets are coming back, and I think I posted this online on your post. Mullets are coming back for the boys, and Brenda had the 80s big hair, New Jersey big hair.
Jersey big
hair. Bring that hair back. I love the big hair. Carrie's amazing, not doing. She does this crazy stuff. Yep. So Brenda says it's not happening. And then you had a chopped caddy.
Yeah, that was pure New Jersey late 80s. Chopped 60 caddy, heavy chopped 60. Yep. The pink 60 caddy.
That was the picture, like your prom with her with the big hair. Was you took her in prom in that, didn't you?
Exactly. Yeah, we took that to the prom. Yeah. So the pink 60 caddy was like my daily driver to high school. And then the Willys pickup was for, you know, weekends. That was my better car.
Yeah. Could you imagine the look on somebody's face if you pulled into a high school parking lot with a pink chopped caddy? Big old caddy now. They wouldn't even have a parking spot big enough for it.
Right. Yep. They got lots of attention. So we ended up selling those two cars when we decided that we're going to get married and, you know, start a family, buy a house. So I used the money I got from those two cars as a down payment on a new house. So those cars left and they were gone. The caddy's still gone, but the blue pickup, the 41 Willys pickup, I own that again. And it wasn't too many years ago, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6, that I got a message from a woman in Pennsylvania saying that her husband recently passed away and that he was the last owner of the Willys pickup. And he told her that when he's gone, to find me, and I'd probably want to buy the Willys back. So I did, and it's exactly the same as how I built it. It looks the same.
It makes Boyd wheels on it, right?
Yeah, Boyd wheels on it, right? And I mean, they fixed a couple of things over the years just from so much use. But other than that, it looks the same. You know, it's the same truck. Still has all the same quirks in it, all the same rattles and vibrations and rough edges and all that stuff. But it's like going back in time. You know,
your high school car, your first car, they didn't like throw the chassis away and put another chassis and throw.
Yeah.
You know, it looks the same.
It looks the same. Yeah. And it's cool. So works. I mean, like, we drove that thing everywhere, like from Jersey to Florida. And, you know, we took it to the NSRA Nationals down in Tampa and Columbus and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We put a lot of mileage on it. I used it as a daily for a long time. It's held up amazingly well for a car that was built by a 14-year-old kid. And, you know, I did everything, the upholstery on it and everything. I did everything myself, and it's still there. And so I'm happy to have it back. You know, it's kind of a neat thing to be able to have like a time machine. Mm-hmm. Because when I sit in that thing, I go right back. I remember how much every part cost, because I had to earn it the hard way. You know, I get $119, I'm going to get 5-lug Mustang 2 rotors, you know, and a street scene, you know, and they were $119. And I'd have to earn the $119 somehow. When I did it, I'd get the rotors and next part. And so I had the advantage of, you know, growing up at my father's repair shop, you know, so there was the ability to have tools around and a welder and stuff like that. But I did build it outside. You know, I couldn't build it in the shop where the work was being done to pay the bills. So I would do what I could, you know, to not be terribly in the way, and built it, finished it for when I had my driver's license. And then we took it to NSRA York. That was kind of like our local, you know, big event. We would go to York every year in June. And Tom Vogley put it on the cover of Street Scene magazine. So that was awesome. Or was it Joe Mayall? I think it was Joe Mayall actually that did. Yeah, Joe Mayall did it. And yeah, so that was like a big shot for me. You know, having a car on the cover of a magazine was like, you know, mind blowing. Yeah. And
back then, of course, everything's changed. There's still very good magazines. There's not as many, but people are still putting out print. But like, when you got a car in a magazine, it pretty much changed a hot rodder's life career. Like 3 months after we was on in our first magazine, I left the dealership and started my shop.
Yeah.
Because the phone just started ringing that much. People paid attention to magazines that much.
Do you remember what it felt like back then when you knew that something that you built was coming out in a magazine and you were waiting for it to appear on newsstands? And we would drive to the news, like we had one good newsstand. It was about 3 towns away. And we would like drive there daily. Like, is it here yet? Is it here yet? You know, and it's not like.
Still, I did a show. Me and my dad made the cover of Modern Hunting, and I was still giddy. You know, they send me the picture of what made the cover, and this, and I just couldn't wait till it come in the mail. All my buddies got their issues first, and I'm still a teenage kid when I get a car in a magazine.
That's cool. Yeah. I don't really get stuff in print that much anymore. Everything is, you know, digital, but which is cool because it comes up, you know, fast and really nice, and it's great, but it does kind of disappear after time, where the magazine or the book, you know, sits on the shelf and you can thumb through it, you know, and it's nice. So a lot of times we'll find some old magazines or pictures that we were in, and it's like, oh man, I forgot that even happened, you know, that we did that stuff.
I love to collect old magazines, and I had some stuff that just showed up in the mail while I was gone. Carrie hates my magazine collection, but my goal is to put an organized library in the upstairs shop with Hunt Rod and Rod and Customs, because
that's
a crazy collection.
That's what that box was?
That were the Andy Southard books, which Andy Southard just passed away. So
yeah,
she's just jealous because she can't read.
No, it's just that we're getting up there. We're getting to that age where you got to start getting rid of your stuff, because nobody that we have beneath us cares about anything we're doing. So, like,
yeah, we don't have kids.
I feel like we're done with that collection stage.
Yeah.
Oh, no, there's still some empty spots I have to fill.
Okay. Back to
I'm a terrible collector. Like I don't collect stuff. Like, I never really did. And like, people will find some Tucker thing, you know, and it's great and it's interesting, but I just pass it along to Sean and Mike. I'm like, here, you know, call these guys, because they're good at that. Like, they're good at collecting something, putting it away properly, and, you know, organizing things. And I was never good at that kind of stuff. I'm like looking for the next thing to do. I don't really look back so much. So recently, Brendan and I, we lived in a you know, pretty big house with a big garage in the suburbs, and that's where we raised our kids. And so in that house, we had, you know, 25 years of stuff, you know, just things that you collect, just stuff that you gather. And the more space you have, the more stuff you have. You just keep filling up areas. And then we had just, we never threw anything away. We just had all the stuff. And then once the kids grew up, we realized, look, we're never really here at this house anymore. We're in the suburbs. We spent all of our time somewhere else. What are we doing here? So, like, on a whim, we totally purged our lives and got rid of everything. And I had a 10-car garage at the house, fully equipped, and I had like enough stuff to build cars at home too. I didn't have any more hours, but I had like more tools. Like, when am I going to build a car at home? You know. So we ended up just purging everything in about 2 months' time. And we moved to a small place here on the ocean and at the beach, and we love it. So, like, I just got all this weight off my shoulders of things that were weighing me down. And the philosophy there was, like, we're going to live in a place or a lifestyle that we're not really interested in just to store stuff that we're not really interested in. What's the point? So we moved things around and gave them to people that could appreciate them more, would use them more, would have a better use for them than we did, or take care of them better than we did, or than I did, and it's been great. So I feel like, you know,
I feel like after this interview is over, I'm gonna have, like, Carrie's gonna sit me down and have a serious conversation with me. So if you get a couple text messages later or tomorrow, some cuss words, just ignore them, because Carrie's chewing my ass. So.
Tried to do that when we moved to Tennessee, but then
that move happened again pretty quick, so we kind of just throwed everything in the trash. I still got crap in the boxes at the shop
we can't get rid of it, because we may, you know, we haven't used it for 12 years, but we may need it next week,
right?
So
what we're saying is, I have stupid stuff, like when I started racing bikes when I was 13, I have the temporary plate from day one, I have the moto sheet off the wall, I have my original Stretch Armstrong doll. I have, my original Hot Wheels. And
That's not me. I don't have that stuff. But I respect it. I mean, I think it's cool that you do.
She must have booked you from counseling for me. When did you start, like, hey, man, I'm going to build hot rods for myself? So you've never worked for anybody, right? It's just worked for your dad, and then you went on to doing what you're doing now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I never really even worked for him. You know, it was like, I didn't have a job in the shop fixing cars. Like, I never even did that. I was like building out Willie's pickup, financing it on my own little projects that I would do. And then I just always did that. Like that's kind of how I existed. I would buy and sell cars or parts or whatever. And then, you know, as time went on, maybe that $300 car that I was flipping, you know, then I would do a little better car, you know, and then it would become a little bit of a hot rod, you know, and then I could flip that hot rod. And that's how I always financed my own builds. by doing that. So I never really had a 9-to-5 job. I never had a normal situation where I was getting a paycheck. It was always like, you got to fund this thing by doing that thing. And that's just always
What
how it happened.
years, like when I started seeing you guys in the magazines and stuff more often, was
Yeah.
you there was Ida Automotive, was you could order a fiberglass Willie's body from you guys.
Right. Yep.
What years was that, and how long did that happen?
So I graduated high school in 1990. And right after high school, it was like, all right, what are we going to do? And I can either get a job, or I can keep doing what I'm doing here with hot rods, but now try to do it for customers. So in the repair shop, occasionally we would do a little bit of hot rod work. Something would come in and I would be involved in that, or we would flip a car, flip a hot rod. And that kind of grew into the next thing. Once I got out of high school, it was like, all right, now we need to do something for real. And we were heavily into Willys. Willys were harder and harder to come by. When you did find one, they needed, 2 years worth of metal work before you could even start to build a car out of it. And fiberglass was like hot and accepted, and it was the thing to do at the time. So we said, we're gonna make some fiberglass Willys bodies and chassis. So we did. We made some plugs, and we made a mold for a 33 and a 41 coupe. We designed a chassis, and we'd fabricate our own chassis. We had Barry Lobeck making the frame rails for us, and he would send us, just truckloads of frame rails, and we would put them in our fixture and build chassis out of them, and then make the bodies and assemble the bodies. And it was good, but it really wasn't what I was about. It was that was probably the closest thing I ever had to like a job. It was like you would get an order and you would build a thing to the order, and this is the options that they wanted, and get the pieces off the shelf and build a chassis, and it's done and goes out. It was just not something I was into. And we did it for probably did it for close to 10 years,
And in that time, you guys built a couple like promo cars.
Yeah, so I was into that, like I would want to build my own car, out of our products. But as far as
Didn't
like
bring this
filling
up
orders.
because you probably didn't bring it up, but you would put mini truck graphics almost on these cars because this was the era of Easter egg colors, which I miss bright colors. I'm fine with pastel colors and painted bumpers coming back too, really. I would be fine with that. But I remember you guys did like a peach Willys with like vanilla shake tear graphics. And in my mind, it was one of the first hand-built fuel injection systems on that. And it had, are you ready? 17-inch wheels on it, right? And it was like, I remember I did a car with 17s on it. And it took me three hot rod parts guys before the third one says, if I sell these to you, don't tell anybody you bought these big diameter wheels because I don't want the hot rod guys making fun of me because this is just a flash in the pan. We're going back to 14s and 15s. 17s are just stupid. Now 17s are tiny, but you did. It was the 33 style Willys that was peach and vanilla, 17s and a fuel injected motor and a lot of other billet parts. So you guys were making a lot of billet at that time. When did you start get like a CNC and start doing that stuff?
It was around that time. I think I built that car you're talking about. It was called the Ice Creamer, and I think it was like 92. I think it was like 92. And buying the tires for that car, it had 335, 35 17s, and only two vehicles used that tire. And it was the Viper that wasn't quite out yet, and it was and a Ferrari like F40 or something. And I remember I had to pay $880 for each tire. And
That's
yeah,
back then.
it was a
Like
lot of
nice
money.
little dance.
It was stupid money. Yeah, so I had to flip a couple of cars to get that. Yeah, it was early on for that kind of look, and I took a lot of heat from that. But it had a 408-inch small block with EFI, and we used that XL system that was kind of brand new at the time. Not very not the fastest processor in the world. So it ran okay, but by today's standards, it was like really basic. But that's what we were doing, like the newest of what you can get.
Yeah, but I
So I
mean,
built that
covering Street Rock,
car.
a couple other mag, it was in a bunch of magazines when it was fresh.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah. So it was right after my pickup. So I was in my early 20s. I don't know, maybe I was I think it was just out of the under 21. Remember, NSR had the under 21. So I must have been 22 because I think I just missed that thing. So I finished it in Jersey, in my shop in Jersey. And my road test was drive it from Jersey to Columbus. And that's what I did. That was like the road test. I had like no mileage on it. Like I just finished it and drove it out there. And I won a pros pick with it, which was awesome. You know, it was like the coolest thing. And I was a big Boyd fan. Yeah, so that was a great experience. And I drove that thing everywhere. I drove it all over the country. And that was a good one. So I owned that car for a long time too. I think I sold that one. Well, maybe I sold that to buy my house or something. But for a while it was my daily. That was my daily driver because I had to sell my actual vehicle because I bought a ZR1 engine to build my 41 coupe. And the ZR1 engine.
We kind of got to know each other. That was the summer we built you the Speedster. And that was the summer I got to know you. Like, we parked that Columbus by you and Dave Tucci when he had the Grand Trail.
Yeah, that was 99.
Yeah, we learned how to power park from you and Tucci.
Oh, yeah.
There's the corner spot. Look what the cool kids are doing. So, yeah. Power parking from you guys.
Yeah. Yeah, 99.
99.
Yep. Yeah, so I was driving the ice creamer, the 33 Willys, as my daily, because I was into Thunderbird Super Coupes back then. So I sold my Super Coupe to buy a ZR1 engine because they were like, that was like the hottest thing in the world. I just had to have one. So I heard that there was a ZR1 that got totaled, like an 18-wheeler drove over the back of it. So I bought the motor and trans from the ZR1 or I bought the whole crash car and then built my 41 around that.
You're really so, good. How much do you have to pay for that wreck ZR1? Do you remember that number? How many of the ZR1s did they make? They didn't make very many of them at all.
No, they didn't make many. And this was a 91. So it was one of the early ones. I don't remember what I paid for it. I feel like it was, you know, around $10,000 or something, but I don't really remember. Yeah.
You tell everybody about that. I know the orange willies.
Yeah.
So it was a fiberglass. It was chopped.
Yep.
Air ride. You built one off wheels. So the ZR1. It was bright pearl orange.
Yeah.
And the wheels at that time were just blew people's mind. So explain the wheels that you built for that thing.
Yeah. So my father did the machine work on the wheels. He was pretty much the machinist in the shop, right? So he would do all the CNC work. So we come up with this idea. We wanted to make wheels, first of all, that were gigantic, right? Because I wanted huge wheels on that little body because I love the proportions of how that looked. So we built super deep dish 20-inch wheels, and we machined the centers out of big blocks of billet. And we put the studs in the wheels, so that the wheels go over the hub or over the axle and they bolt in from the back. So there's no cap, you know, that little line for the cap that used to pop off on the Boyd wheels. We don't want to see that look. We want it all.
It has to need to change if you have a flat along the freeway.
Yeah. I mean, even if you can get the lugs off, you're not getting a wheel out of that fender anyway, you know? So, yeah, that was the least of my problems, but, we built the wheels. We built the brake calipers, the differential, the A-arms, the suspension, full billet grill. Like, you know, we were just going wild with the CNC machine at the time.
Yeah, and so everybody said, make sure they pay attention. What year were you doing all this billet stuff again?
Let's see. I finished that car in 99. So I was probably working on it around, from 97 or something like that. Because at the time, we moved into our house and we had a baby. And so Gianna was brand new. And so I built that car mostly at home in my two-car garage. Most of the work happened there in my two-car garage, not at my shop. So that meant I was doing it after hours, you know, all night long in the garage and at home or on weekends or whatever. There was no abundance of time. You know, there was no extra time for anything. It was either work or family, and that was it, nothing else. I remember working in my garage at home. You know, I didn't have any heat in there. I was in there one night working and a pipe broke because it was so cold, you know, and now I'm dealing with a broken pipe, you know, while it's blowing all over my car that I'm trying to build. Got it done and brought it to the shop to paint it and do the assembly. But most of it happened at home in my two-car garage. We made a windshield for it.
That was was kind of an industry changing car at that time, because it was just like, again, people take for granted, oh yeah, we just call this guy, we have these billet parts made or one-off wheels made, but that really wasn't a thing back then. That was
I even made the windshield, if you remember, it had a curved windshield. And so I made a metal plug for the windshield, and I found somebody that could bend glass, and they made me a safety plate windshield. And yeah, so I made a lot of parts for that car. It was definitely something that I wanted everything a little different, but not for the fact that I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be different because I was finding room for improvement in each line, right? So I don't just cut the roof because I know how to chop a top. I cut the roof because I wanted to lay the A-pillars back, and I wanted to change the proportions and make the fenders look bigger, and I sloped the hood down, and I did all these subtle changes in lines, which meant remaking body panels and all that stuff, because I wanted the overall look, and that silhouette to be there. And I noticed that, a lot of cars that, especially the cars that are very competitive, they're polished to death when you get up close to them, right? They're just perfect. But when you stand back, 100 feet away, it may not have the proper arrangement. Mm-hmm. And you can't overlook the arrangement, right? That's number one. And if the car has the right arrangement and the proportions are right and the stance and the wheels, but the arrangement is right on the body, it really doesn't matter if it's in primer or bare metal or rusty or polished to perfection. It either has it or it doesn't. And there are so many cars that are polished to death, but they missed step one. And step one is the overall arrangement. And so I'm always more interested in the arrangement than I am, how well it's finished. Because the finish really comes with dollars and hours. Right. So you can polish anything if the budget is there. If they can keep having you polish it more and more and more, you can get it there.
One of my favorite polish quotes is from Roger Berman. Trying to get Roger Berman on here. He's done all kinds of stuff in the industry, but he doesn't want to do an interview or a podcast or something like that. Yeah. He's just a little bit more private guy. But he did a hard top Henry J one year that won Customer Out of the Year at Good Guys. And they used to do that award at Des Moines. And Roger being Roger, he's not really PG-13, but he was that day, but he's still, what'd you do to this car to make it? It had modern headlights. It was like that same era, like late 90s type of thing. He goes, well, it's a Henry J. I got out the turd polish and started rubbing. Roger Berman quotes.
Yeah.
Polish up anything, but
style.
Yeah. We've all seen a car. Even at a swap meet or a cruising, it's like the thing's in primer, but it sits right. The tire's
perfect.
Right. Yep. It's like, that thing. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And then we've all seen those cars at the indoor show, and we're thinking, what were these people thinking?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it wins everything because it's got all these things that
for points.
Check the boxes off.
100%. Yeah. I've always been way more impressed with the car with the proper arrangement than with all the polish.
So again, we'll do it while you're saying that, and you said that, so that brought up. You're now, you don't chase awards. You build cars for the craft and the art, and say, we'll come back and get some more of the story of moving on. But I remember you took that car that we'll talk about, the car that you put on your plaque. That, I always say his name.
The 40 Mercury.
Yeah. And you took it to SEMA, and everybody's like, why didn't you enter Battle of the Builders? And I have the same thought process. This was like, what's that? Are we wrestling?
Yeah, right.
But you ended up getting the Ford Design Award for best of show Ford because of what the car is. It's incredible. And then the customer wanted you to take it to Sacramento, and you basically got, they call it Custom d'Elegance, but it's America's Most Beautiful Custom Award thing. Yeah. And, but you just, we're kind of that way too. We don't like to chase awards. We like to create the car for cool people, build something that we're going to be proud of. If we get something fine. And a lot of people concentrate too much on, I need that Riddler trophy in my case, or I need that AMBR trophy or something like that. I'm not saying I don't really care to do a Riddler car, but I might do an AMBR contender or something. But it's, you do it for the craft and the art, right? That's kind of, you see quotes from you that way. And he's like, you don't care about awards. You don't chase the awards. You just want to create and kind of push the envelope.
Yeah, for sure. So the car that you're talking about, that Merc, I wouldn't really competed for anything. And when people said you should have entered it in the Riddler Award, I said, well, it's not built for that. right? So that's a very specific way to build a car. Mm-hmm. And it's like saying, well, I built a the winning NASCAR, but I took it to the drag strip and it lost. You know, it's two different things, right? So for me to build a car, I would have to specifically build it to compete for that award, and it would be a different thing. So it wouldn't be the car that I built, it would be something else. Yeah. And it wouldn't be something that my heart is in. If you remember, like, the belly pan on that Merc, it was a fully finished belly pan on the bottom, but it was like mill finished aluminum. For me to compete at maybe Detroit, I probably would have chromed that. And it wouldn't have
Detroit, they hate belly pans. Oh, yeah. Detroit.
You're hiding it.
Yeah. You're covering something up you don't want us to see.
Well, these parts were all articulated. So they actually moved. So they moved with the suspension. So it was active. But I probably would have finished it differently. You know, I would have finished it in chrome, and I wouldn't have liked that. It would have been overdone. I mean, it was such thought that went into the balance of polished versus mill finished versus satin and paint. And in the end, you know, I feel like the car had good arrangement and good balance, so that you're able to look at it and not remember just one thing, right? The whole car kind of was balanced front to back. You know, does it have a better front or back? They're equal, you know, then top and bottom equal. So I didn't want, you know, one thing to be the star of the show. I wanted the whole car to be in good balance. And yeah, like, we picked a mild color
with the skirts that move in the front, and there's all kinds of stuff that goes on in that car. And I mean, it won major, major stuff, and you weren't even trying. You got in all the right magazines for, you know, it was in Hop Up, I think, and stuff. And to me, that car is so memorable. Even if you would have done and won the Riddler, it wasn't going to make that car any more memorable other than on a list. Now it's a Riddler winner, because that car is so incredible and different that people still talk about that car. That's going to be a car in 30 years. You pull that thing out, it's still bitching. It's got a look that's not, it's a timeless, it's a coach built car. You're not a hot rod builder, you're a coach builder in my mind. So.
Oh, well, thanks. Thank you. We built that car with all modern technology, but you can't see any of it, right? All of it looks like it's being presented like a traditional build car.
Yeah, what's the motor in that?
The motor is it's a Shelby GT500 engine. So it's that 4-cam, 32-valve Ford, which is a great engine. It makes, you know, lots of power, and it's reliable, and, you know, all those things are great, but they're not beautiful, right? So it looks like a piece of equipment. It doesn't look like a, you know, piece of artwork. So we made like valve covers that kind of made it look like an Arden, and mm-hmm. we made it. It is supercharged, but we made a supercharger casing for it that looks like a Scott supercharger, and oil bath style air cleaners. So all these things that look like old parts, but it's really modern technology in that. Yeah. And so that was kind of the idea of that car. So, you know, the customer wanted certain things, like he wanted that engine, and it is a great engine, but it just didn't look good in there. So we had to make it look like it fit fit the part.
Yeah, it's a problem to me with like the new supercharged LT4 motors. They just look like there wasn't even a designer involved in the thought process of that thing.
Right.
Yeah.
You got to make it look good. Yeah. The engineering is fantastic, but the aesthetic isn't there.
So we kind of jumped around. We were to go back again. We are after your Orange Willys. What came after the Orange Willys?
After the orange one. Then we started to get into Tuckers, right? So we did our fiberglass Tuckers. We did a blue one that was kind of in the. It was on Super Rod. Remember John Diana's magazine? It was there. And then I stopped traveling so much after that because I was raising a family. So I wasn't really hitting all the NSRA events and the Good Guys events. I took some time off. I was still building cars. I just wasn't really promoting them or bringing them and showing them and that kind of stuff for quite a long time. But we got involved in land speed racing, and we got involved in restorations of Tuckers.
Now you're moving too fast. We need to go back the reproduction Tuckers for a little bit. With your stuff that you learned doing the Willys, you guys popped a Tucker and did a fiberglass Tuckers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you can't just, it's not like you're building a Camaro. Hey, we can order the bumpers from an aftermarket company. So you had to build the bumpers and everything. And so how did you, obviously, you know, some Tucker people. So somebody lets you measure a Tucker, right?
Correct. Yeah. So we had a close friend who's passed away now from New Jersey, and his father also had a Tucker dealership. So he had this love for Tucker cars. And back in the I guess 70s or maybe early 80s, he puts an ad in Hemmings magazine, wanted Tucker or Tucker parts, or probably just Tucker parts, whatever. And his name is Chick DiLorenzo. Great guy. You know, he was pretty much like we are. He loved to make cars and make parts and just, you know, do whatever he wanted. Very creative guy. And so he had this love for Tuckers, but never imagined he would own one. And based on this ad that he put in Hemmings where he's looking for Tucker parts, he gets a call from someone who just purchased an automotive museum. And part of this museum acquisition included a partial Tucker. So it was like a Tucker body on a frame, no fenders, no bumpers, no other parts. And it had a couple of engines. So he bought this partial car and made the rest of the parts. And so at the time they were making the movie, Tucker, the mm-hmm. Man in the Stream, Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas were making this movie. So they put the word out, any Tucker owner that has a car that wants to be a part of the movie, you know, we want to have you there. So Chick got involved in that and he sent his car out to California and he went out there. And with the help of Francis Ford Coppola and all these resources that he brought, Chick was able to finish his car. And he finished it with, yeah, he was able to finish it with fiberglass fenders and parts and copied some stuff. And so now he had a car and he called it number 51 because it wasn't one of the original 50, but it was made from extra parts. So he always had this idea. He wanted to get into the kit car world and make his own Tucker. So he made a mold of a car. And it was crude. You know, it wasn't really something that was going to make a car, and it wasn't a successful venture based on the resources that he had. I mean, he was a maintenance guy in a hospital. So he had limited time, limited resources and tools and money, but he did the best he could. So then once we met, we said, oh, maybe we can kind of combine our resources and talents and knowledge, and we can get together and do this. So we did. We made our own mold and our own buck and everything to make a car. And based on him having a car, we were able to get all this information from him. And so the deal was that I'm going to make a mold and a car, and he gets to have the first one out of the mold, and he's going to make a car out of it. So that's what we did. And we gave him a body, and he made a car out of it. And then, and unfortunately, shortly after that, he got a brain tumor, and he was ill for some time. So I bought the car back that he was building with my body. And so I still have it. It's at my place now. But after that, we built a couple of cars, and I have one in Japan and a couple here locally. I built one recently for Jack Kiley, who owns the 40 Merc that you were talking about earlier. And we brought that to SEMA in 2017. And so we finished that car for him.
Is that the Keystone green one?
No, it's blue. It's like a pale blue twin turbo car. It was on Hot Rod. Couple of years ago. Yeah. And so we did that. And then shortly after that, we decided.
Planes and then?
Twin turbo North Stars.
Okay.
So it had a Caddy North Star VA transverse mounted. So it's mounted sideways, mid engine, right behind a rear seat. And it worked out pretty well. But again, I didn't like being in the kit car or, you know, repro business. You know, that whole kind of factory work isn't for me. So I decided after that, I'm not really going to be offering them as, you know, that kind of a car. So I'll build one here and there. And you know, the next one I build will probably be metal, because I think that I want to take the molds that I have and the parts that I have and use that as a buck and make a metal body. But I'm not doing that anytime soon. Right now, I'm making the Tucker Carioca. And
you also did the Tucker that was never built. It was the sketch.
Yeah. So they were
built that from
two different. Yeah, two different things. There was the Tucker Torpedo, and that was the car that Preston Tucker dreamed of before he made his production car. So anytime we think of the Tucker 48, we think of, you know, the famous car with the three headlights and the swoopy, you know, body line. But before he made that car, before he made 50 of those cars, he had this other concept in mind, and it was the Tucker Torpedo. And it was
a car design. Almost every car starts like that. oh, here's our design. And then, oh, we have to put bumpers on because of this. Yeah. And then we have to do this. And, oh, right. We got to get the top right so people can sit in them. So everything right. gets changed from the initial sketch.
Yes.
So you did the car that was the initial design.
Yes. So what you just described is exactly what happened. So Tucker had this idea for like a center drive car. So imagine like this turret style roof, very round, wraparound windshield, and the driver sitting up in the middle.
Because speaking of Tucker, hate to interrupt you. But yeah. one of the things that he invented was a turret thing for the military, right? Around.
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep. So he liked that.
He made a turret for a tank.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he designed that. So then when he was thinking about making a car, he thought it would be cool to have the driver in the center, you know, for kind of better visibility, and then passengers flank him on the side. The problem with that is entry and exit for the car, right? So you're going to open a door, and then you're going to kind of close this butterfly style door and then walk to your seat in the center of the car in this round roof. It's just not practical. Like, it's an awesome concept, but the reality is nobody wants to get in their car and get in and out of a turret, you know, walking out of a car. So they realized quickly that that's not practical. So they went back to a more traditional squared off roof with a driver on the left and a passenger next to him. And then they hired Alex Tremulis to design what we know as a Tucker 48. Mm-hmm. And then after the company closed and the auction happened, so the government came in, auctioned off all of Tucker's assets. So 50 cars, all the equipment, all the leftover parts, everything that Tucker Corporation owned was auctioned off. And Preston Tucker himself went to that auction. And so did my grandfather, by the way. He went there trying to buy a Tucker, but he was out of money at that point and he couldn't even get one. So Preston Tucker himself went to the auction and purchased three cars. And one of them is Tucker number 29, which is now in my shop. We're restoring it. In fact, I just painted it last week. We're doing a full restoration on Tucker number 29 with Mark Lieberman of Nostalgic Motors in Michigan. And he's overseeing the whole restoration project. So the body and the fabrication is all happening in my place now. And so, yeah, that car that Tucker owned is now at my place.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So after the Tucker Corporation closed, then he moved to South America, and Preston Tucker had this new idea. He's going to work on a new car. And it was the Tucker Carioca was the concept. So imagine like this lightweight, nimble, almost like a Porsche Speedster. It's got an air-cooled four-cylinder Franklin airplane engine in the rear because Tucker owned Franklin, right? So he bought the Franklin engine company. And that's what he used in his 48 car, is a six-cylinder version. Then he was going to use the four-cylinder version in the Carioca. Unfortunately, he died of lung cancer before the project got off paper. So we took any information that was left behind on paper, and we've now created a full-size buck, and the chassis is just about completed, working with Bob Cuneo of Chassis Dynamics on a fully fabricated chassis, and it has a airplane engine in the back. So that's the car we're building now, the 55 Tucker Carioca.
So how many Tuckers do you think you've worked on, counting the fiberglass ones, the ones that you're restoring, the one that you built and made drive, and then the one you're doing now, and all the restoration. How many Tuckers have you actually touched and worked on?
I guess from the original Tuckers, we did, I don't know, maybe five original Tuckers. So that's like 10%. Yeah, that's 10% of them. So I think about five of the originals. We made four fiberglass bodies, the Torpedo, and then now the Carioca. So
fabrication question.
Yeah.
I can shape some metal. I can do some stuff. I understand how bucks work. But yeah. Back in the day when you built a car like that, you built the buck from like scratch. So isn't there, like, how did you do the buck on that new car? I've seen the buck that I've seen pictures online that it's in your showroom of the new car you're building. How does that buck happen?
So here's how we did that car. We took the artist renderings that existed. Okay. So they were like, you know, three-quarter versions of a car design that was not gone through all of the changes that the engineers would have implemented, right? It was just purely the artist rendering. And as we know, as you mentioned earlier, when a car goes from the artist, you know, through all the other channels in a car company, you know, the legal department gets involved and the marketing department gets involved and manufacturing and engineering, all these other influences change the shape of the car, and usually towards something that you can actually make. The problem is when you're dealing with simply the artist rendering, now you're left to either make changes or make this artist rendering actually work. So that's what we're doing. We're making the artist rendering actually work. So we took kind of these different views that were left behind that didn't always quite match up. They were, you know, sometimes contradictory. And at the time I reached out to Tom Taylor, and we made a blueprint.
Are you
of what
in
we
trouble, Brendan? You keep, are you in trouble? You keep.
Oh, no, no, I'm good. No, I'm good.
Brendan, just jump in and say hello.
Yeah, no, that's not her. So we took all these drawings and we made a pencil drawing of like a blueprint of what the car could be. And then as time went on, we took that information and we put it into CAD. And then we drew the entire car in CAD. So in SolidWorks, we have the entire body, the surfaces, and every piece of equipment that goes in that car. Everything is on CAD, building the entire car in CAD. So the Buck, it went from a two-dimensional drawing to a three-dimensional Buck through the CAD system, right? So now we're able to have a drawing for every station that you see in that Buck. And then Sean Tucker took the information from the CAD, put it on a CNC router, routed out all those parts, and then they just fit together like a puzzle. And now here we have a full-size station Buck to build the parts on. And when I did this book,
technology, you're using modern technology. Like I know on that one Tucker that you built, like the steering wheel, I remember reading about that and the Tucker boys.
Yep.
Oh, this was designed, but how does it work? So you made it work through Bluetooth technology, made it look old. So the technology with the scanners and all of that stuff with the just making the buck alone saves so much time with all this technology, doesn't it? Because otherwise you'd have to cut all that stuff by hand.
You'd have to cut it by hand, and we know how inaccurate, you know, that is, right? And then you have to deal with all those inaccuracies, and you have to kind of follow them all the way through and then either, you know, fix it early on or later. But either way, all those things need to be dealt with. Same thing in CAD, but you can fix it on the computer screen before you even put your hands on a piece of metal. So it's way more efficient using CAD for most things. So we use a combination of, you know, the most archaic technology, you know, like a power hammer or an English wheel and a hammer and a piece of wood. But we marry that technology into the most modern technology by using, you know, 3D printers and scanners and CAD. So we try to find the most efficient way possible to get the things done. So we love doing the work, but we don't want to work more than we need to. You know, we want to get it done as good as we can, but as efficiently as we can.
So when we're talking about technology now in metal shaping, now is a good time to talk about. You had a bunch of posts of that. What is that called? The shaping machine.
Yeah, so it's Figure.
Yeah.
It's a CNC metal forming machine. Yeah.
And you're kind of involved.
So in that's the... they happen to be local.
You scan it and it make a mold and you scan it and it like shapes it to a point, doesn't it?
It's similar like to, you know, machining something on a CNC machine where you're able to draw the thing on CAD, take that information and... Like we're going to cut out a buck using CAD. Well, now we could go right to metal shaping with CAD. So this CNC metal shaping system, it's not the answer to all metal shaping. It has its place, but it does not replace a power hammer or an English wheel or just a talented human being. It does not replace them.
You still got to figure out a flange or mounting system or weld it in and metal face part. So it's
correct. And it's also not going to make every part. And here's why. So as you know, when we metal shape and we fabricate car parts or anything that we're doing in 3D, we use a series of techniques. One is shrinking, right? Shrinking is a big part of metal shaping. For me, you know, I do a lot of shrinking on Polmax or I have an Urco or an Eckhold. So shrinking is a big part of what we do. Stretching, we're using a power hammer, a Polmax, English wheel, bag, all those things are for stretching. The Figure CNC machine cuts out the ability to make certain parts. Because if you're only going to stretch, well, a few things are going to happen. One, it's going to get too thin, right? And you can't turn things back in. So you can only do one side. So it, but it wouldn't take the place of, you know, a handmade part. Mm-hmm. So it can play a role in building a car, but it really wouldn't make sense to try to build an entire car with that type of technology.
Yeah.
I think eventually it'll do both. It'll do shrinking and stretch. A more viable option if you wanted to make an entire car that way. But right now there is a place for it, but it's not going to do everything.
It's pretty crazy. I think it's totally
insane. It is. Yeah.
You think
so? Figure happens to be close to us.
Most nights, so the scanners and the CNC stuff, I rely on. It goes a little smarter than being here. That's the cool thing about this industry.
Well, that's okay, and so do I. So we have like an engineering department right in the shop, and Tyler he runs the scanner and the CAD work, and you know, and so you can't do everything. I mean, you can, but how many things can you fit in your day? You know,
yeah.
There's only so much time, and there's only so much, you know, a view that can go around. And if you're going to concentrate heavily on one area, you really need help to be able to concentrate and do everything well. You know, you can.
But you recently added that. You said his name. This guy, he has the scanners and all that stuff, and the 3D printers, and you have all that stuff, and you're using that a lot on that Corvette that you're cutting up too.
Yeah, so a Corvette is, you know, as we know, it's a fiberglass body, and we changed all the arrangement on that car, right? So we moved the roof down and back, and we made the nose longer, and we're changing all the proportions of this factory-built Corvette body to look more like the prototype body that Bill Mitchell designed prior to the manufacturing. Just like how we were talking about earlier, when an artist designs a car for manufacture, then it goes through all the changes that, you know, again, the marketing department and the engineering department, they all have an input on what the finished vehicle looks like. So in this project, we're able to kind of bypass all those other things because we don't need to build a car that is going to, you know, fit 85% of the population. It doesn't have to really pass DOT. It doesn't have to be easy to manufacture because we're only making one. So we don't have to worry about all the other things that General Motors had to worry about. We're able to kind of go right back to the artist and what did Bill Mitchell and his team want that Corvette to look like. So that's kind of what we're doing with this car. We're going, you know, back to the roots of that design. So in that, we're now having to make body panels. And when we've made body panels for fiberglass parts in the past, what are you doing? You're going to make it out of something. You're going to make it out of wood or Bondo or clay. You know, you're going to shape it out of something and then make a fiberglass piece and then finish that by hand and get it on the car. Now we're able to design it on CAD. So we use SolidWorks. We took a three-dimensional scanning of the back of this Corvette. So we knew exactly what all the parameters were. Then we designed the body panel the way we wanted it to look. We 3D printed a female version of it. So now we had a mold that was 3D printed. And then by hand, I laid in the fiberglass and the resin and created a part, popped the 3D printed mold off it. And here I go. I have a part it's made, it's perfect, and it's exactly the same left to right, you know, because we were able to mirror image just half of the mold. So we know it's exactly the same. And if I did it by hand, it would be reasonably close to the same, but it's not going to be exactly the same because it's a handmade piece. And it would have taken much more time, you know, more man hours and more materials. So when we had the 3D printers going, you know, we're home sleeping at night and these printers are going all night and making the piece. We come in the morning and there's our mold. So the efficiency is there when you start to work.
Our internet's pausing a little bit, so when we get a panic look on you're freezing a little bit, and then you pop back in again. So you've also got a pretty wild Jaguar that you're modifying in there too.
The Jaguar, yeah. So the Jaguar was designed by Jeff Allison, and they already had this thing cooked up before they came to me. And usually I'm doing a lot of my own design work, or at least the concept is mine. And this time, they came to me with a fully finished design, which I've never experienced that before. They came to me with this idea saying that we want to build this car and we think you're the right guy to build it, because in European cars, I'm into, you know, kind of early concept stuff and weirdo things. And that it needed quite a bit of, you know, metal fabrication. We pretty much remade the whole car, starting with a 2+2. We cut the whole body off the shell or off the structure. We shortened the structure by 9 inches, and then we remade all the body panels. So yeah, that car's all made. The body is, I wouldn't say finished, but it's probably 90% fabricated. And she needed us to take a little bit of a pause, you know, during COVID. So in that time, we started a few other builds and wait for me to finish a few more cars before I can get back on it.
It's, if you guys haven't seen it, it's like the sexiest Jaguar ever being built. So it's incredible. So
thank you.
So we've been talking for about an hour now. We try not to go too crazy. But there's some other stuff you've done. It's like, I always said that, of course, you got inducted in the Rod and Custom Car Hall of Fame this year, and I got to give an induction speech. So you've always kind of went after some different things. Obviously, we've been talking about all this stuff. And one time, didn't you do like, you've done a couple movie cars, right? Didn't you do like something?
Yeah.
What were the movie cars you did?
We did Sin City. We did a Tucker for Sin City. That was Robert Rodriguez, Frank Miller. We did cars for a Will Smith movie. It was I Am Legend. Tom Cruise movie. It was War of the Worlds. Denzel Washington, where he played Bumpy Johnson. I don't remember the name of the movie. Yeah, so we did. It was also Indiana Jones. We did the cars for the last movie that they made. So we've done other cars that were in TV shows and commercials and things like that. You know, being close to New York, sometimes we get these opportunities to do these stunt cars. I haven't been doing too many lately just because we can't fit them in. They're usually on a very short schedule. So I kind of try to stay away from those things that are impossible deadlines anymore. You know, I did the impossible deadline thing for too long.
Getting too old for that.
Yeah, I don't really want that.
Did you do an ice cream truck one time too?
I did, yeah. It was a marketing vehicle. It was a solar powered ice cream system for a solar company, and yeah, we did that for a marketing company. That was another one of those, you know, crazy deadline things that we built way too fast.
And then a couple other ones. I don't know. You can just say no. I can't talk about it. But you were developing. You had pictures in your shop. I know me and you, we talked more than just being on this. You had a track system for little cars in your shop. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Okay. So the Race of Gentlemen happens here in New Jersey. It's the race on the beach where you see like these old, you know, Model A's and stuff being built for sand racing on the beach. So my friend Mel is the creator of that event, and he like me, he likes to involve the next generation into the car hobby. All right, so I'm always like, just like how you guys are with BMX. I feel the same way. In fact, yesterday we just had the Asbury Park Circuit here, which is kind of this big car community that is at the beach. We did a Little League Day parade. So I'm not involved in a Little League. I don't have kids in a Little League, but it's the community, and I want to bring, you know, kind of exposure to the car community to the next generation. So I'm always into doing that kind of thing.
He keeps mentioning this beach thing. What is that?
Sounds like you got a spare room. Sounds like she wants to come visit and stay.
You got to come and stay. Stay at the beach. Yeah.
Like here in the last 10 years, that's my dream job, is I want to sell flip-flops on the beach.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Behind you is the beach.
Yeah, that's the Atlantic Ocean right there. Yeah. Oh,
man. We need to come visit the Ida soon.
Yeah, you should. You should come and see. Yeah. So Mel had this idea of having something for the kids to do at the Race of Gentlemen, because, you know, he wants it to be like a family event where people are encouraged to bring their little kids and have them somehow be involved. So we built this track and these little cars that go down a gravity slope. You know, the kids climb up this tower and they let the cars down and they race. So now, to take that one step further, in my shop, I built this gigantic track that is just for little kids to build a car and a little workstation, tune the cars up, and let them gravity race down the track. And so I created this track, and we're going to have it at the Race of Gentlemen and some other events around where we could kind of attract people that may not really be interested in cars. You know, they may not have any reason to even know what an old car is or any kind of car. And we want to make it available so that those people can feel like they're included too and have a reason to come and be involved. You know, one thing that I experienced as a kid hanging around my father and other car guys, there was always this feeling like they didn't want to talk to the kids. You know, I was like kind of in the way. And I see it a lot, especially here at the Asbury Park circuit, where people get in this little clique of their type of car, right? And this is the only kind of car I like. And if you don't have this, I don't want you here. I don't want to talk to you. You don't belong here. I see this a lot. And we all know that the car community is a small community. I mean, when you look at the planet, mm-hmm. we're a very, very small little group of people. Yep. We need to be more supportive of each other.
I had that explained to me when I was doing the TV show about when we was talking about ratings and viewership and why they didn't advertise and all that stuff. And they go, you have to realize the people that watch TV, not the whole world, but just the TV people, the people that watch automotive stuff, you know, we're all car people. So we know you're motorcycle people, and it blows my mind. Even the people that, if you include like Formula One, IndyCar, and drag race people and NASCAR, it's like a 0.00% of the people that watch TV.
Yeah.
There's more people that watch soap operas in the world that want to watch a car show.
For sure.
So that tells you, you have to support because we're so small.
So small. Yeah. And then to have this attitude where like, oh, I don't like those cars. They don't belong here. And I see this all the time. We have this thing here in Asbury Park. It's called the Asbury Park Circuit. It was this car gathering of mostly race cars that would show up in street race here at the beach. And it started in the 50s and it kind of ended in the maybe late 70s or early 80s. And it went away. So we brought it back recently. Now it's not street racing, but it's a gathering for cars. You know, think of like a small Woodward Dream Cruise here, right? And it's beautiful. It's on the beach and people love to come here, and there's things to do other than just look at the cars. You can park your car, you can go and have a great dinner or something like that. But it's a community. And in the beginning, a couple of years ago, we were dealing with people that, I only want to see traditional cars. And if I don't see traditional hot rods, I don't want to see cars with those wheels on it. Mm-hmm. And then it got into, I don't want to see people with a new Challenger. You know, they don't belong here. That's a new Corvette. It doesn't belong here. And I'm like, no. If you keep doing that, there's going to be no car community. Like, you need to support, just because you don't like his car, you don't have to go look at it. You don't have to take a picture of it. You can just like your car.
Yeah. And the thing is that everything except the diesel guys that roll coal.
Yeah. Well, we want it so that everybody can come here. And if a young guy wants to come in here with a Subaru, he shouldn't be made to feel like he doesn't belong. If that's his car, that young guy in a new Subaru is no different than a guy back in 1948 with a 32 Ford.
I mean, for instance, our good friend Tucci. Dave's a traditional hot rod builder and pro street guy and built race cars and built all the stuff. Well, now his son, the next generation, like we were talking, he does the 3D stuff, the scanning, the printing. And he just built, Mercedes.
Yeah, it's Mercedes. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah.
I mean, because that's what he's in, is that next generation of stuff. And it's amazing.
Great. Yeah. So, I mean, I've always been into like every kind of car. So I was just at the circuit the other day, and there was a beautiful 56 Chevy, right? And it was yellow. And I said to one of the guys, I go, man, look how nice that 56 looks. Like it was just so right. And he goes, he should put checkers on it and call it a taxi cab. I'm like, all right, now you're going to pick on this guy's yellow car. Like, like in five more years, you're going to wish that you were standing next to that guy in that car. You know, like you better make him feel like he's welcome and encouraged. You're going to complain about his car because it's yellow. I mean, what more can he do for you? You know, did he just clone your car? And then would that make you happy? You know, if he had the exact same car as you? So, people need to open their minds up a little bit more and realize that the car community is about the people, really more than the cars. But the cars are an expression of what you like. Maybe it doesn't fit your taste, but maybe it fits that guy's budget. Maybe he doesn't have
It's not for everybody, but that's her interpretation of what hair is supposed to be.
Exactly.
Yeah. But hey, that's for anything in this world.
So speaking of like different cars, you've also done some stuff with, you like Porsches too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been into Volkswagens and Porsches and, you know, all that air-cooled stuff. I've always liked that.
You had one that was like your daily for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I usually have a Porsche, you know, at least one. I have that. And recently I just picked up a Golf K120, and I'll be doing some customizing, or I've been doing some customizing on that one. So I've just always liked weird stuff, and it doesn't have to keep being, you know, a hot rod. I love hot rods. I love gassers. I love all that stuff. Always will, but I like other stuff too. And I appreciate other cars. Even if I don't have to own one, I could still get it. You know, I could still appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah. We should probably wrap this up, but we could do like three more parts of this, of all the stuff that I'd want to ask you and things that I know from hanging out with you. But you also did a cool, what was the Land Speed motorcycle thing that you kind of, painted a Tucker to go with that?
Correct. Yeah. So, We talked about how Preston Tucker, first he designed the turret type mm-hmm. car, then he hired Alex Tremulous to design the car that he produced 50 of. Alex Tremulous designed in the 60s, he designed what was known as the Gyronaut X1. So after, you know, he kind of retired from car design, he went Land Speed racing. So Bob LaPan, he was a drag race, a motorcycle drag racer, teamed up with Alex Tremulous, and they designed the world's fastest motorcycle. So it looked like this rocket ship, but it was actually a motorcycle on two wheels. And they designed it to race at Bonneville. And it was the world's fastest motorcycle during the same time that Burt Munro had the world's fastest Indian. And they raced together a lot. They would pit together and they were friends. This was the overall world's fastest motorcycle. And so it raced from 1964 to 1970. And it crashed in 70, and it laid crashed for all these years. Then in 2014, Alex Tremulous's nephew, Steve Tremulous out in California, purchased it, sent it to us, and we restored the body and made it whole again, brought it out to Bonneville for its 50th anniversary, where we towed it with one of our replica Tuckers to kind of represent two iconic designs by Alex Tremulous. And it tied it.
She would do. If I wanted to start building Bonneville vehicles tomorrow, she'd be like, okay, let's do it. Yeah,
maybe we love Bonneville. They're selling some of our stuff.
It's awesome. Bonneville's an awesome thing. You haven't been there?
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
The first time we went out there, he thought, okay, she's going to come out and be like, no. And I came out.
Because you booked your flight like in the last week. Like yeah. I was going because we have good friends that race and have records since the 60s in their family, the Hope family.
Yeah.
Which we're going to get them
we
on
here. We were both at different events and I was going and I was like, kind of want to go.
Yeah.
I fell in love.
I thought she was going to be there for like watching. No, we're not doing this. No. Within the first hour of the cars going down, she goes, we should do this.
Yeah.
But
it was a year that it rained and we get out there in the rental car and I'm like driving out thinking I am going so fast. These people are flying by me
because
I'm going really slow.
Right. Yeah.
It was totally like that scene in Talladega Nights when he comes back from his wreck. What? So fast because like the people on the drive-in was passing her because she was going like 15 mile an hour.
Well, you need to get started because it takes like, you know, 10 years to do Bonneville because you build this car and then it rains and then it gets flooded out and then you gotta wait a year and then it happens again and then you go there and you break and it takes you 10 years to be successful there. At least
our best friends that we have, some of our best friends from down here, they live close and they do Nitro cars and Bonneville cars, and on the same size as Brian, and he, after they bump up their record, he says in the future they might let one or both of us get in the car and at least do a couple runs on the rookie class, you know, orientation and go through all that and go through tech and everything with it. So, and they want me to do some work on the car, so that's the cheapest way for us to at least get a little time on Bonneville. But then it would probably like, we're really probably would want to build, like I had everything planned. We wanted to build like an OBS truck, a crew cab, all that type of thing. Cause they opened up all the records and the truck stuff, but you don't just go to Bonneville and get a record. I mean, there's so much stuff, but it is absolutely amazing. If you know, I highly recommend everybody I've been lucky. I've stood on the starting line for Nitro cars and pits at Indy cars and all the stuff that I've been blessed to do. In Bonneville, you cannot explain it until you go there.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing for sure. Yeah.
So awesome.
So I know you're a big drag race fan. I'm sorry?
The green Ford truck. Did you run that at Bonneville? Or was
yeah,
that
so yeah, we built that for SEMA initially. It was one of those dollar truck programs that we did back in, I don't even remember, 2005 maybe or something. And then after, you know, the 18-month period, like, what do you do with this thing? So my father always wanted to race something at Bonneville. So we said, oh, let's take this truck. And it really wouldn't take much to, you know, prep it and get it out there. So so he took it out there and it went 200 miles an hour. And it was, you know, it's totally streetable truck, but it ran 200. You know?
And that's got the aerodynamics of a brick. So you can only push a brick so fast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Through the air. So, yeah. So.
And I made the body for... do you know Bob Dornheim? He's from New Jersey. He's been racing at Bonneville for, you know, for 40 years, I think.
Say his name. On our end, the internet paused through the same. Say his name.
Bob Dornheim. Yeah, Bob Dornheim. He's well known for building drag race chassis, dragsters, and funny cars for lots of years. And so after his retirement, he decided to do some Bonneville racing. So he built a Lakester, and it had a body that he fabricated that really wasn't very swoopy, and he took it out there and he did okay with it, but we made him a new body. We designed a body. We didn't use a wind tunnel. We just kind of guessed on what we thought would work well.
The wind tunnels are really expensive.
Yeah. We had the opportunity to actually get the thing in a wind tunnel, but we just didn't have the time. Mm-hmm. So we got it done. It took it out there, and the body that we designed by, you know, kind of guessing at it made his car go 21 miles an hour faster.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah. Yep.
That's a lot of Bonneville to improve that.
It is. It's a lot faster. Yeah.
2 miles crazy to improve.
Correct. Yeah. Made a big, big change. So, yeah, he's been kind of knocking on the door of a record for quite some time. He's gone faster than a record, but he didn't back it up because it would break or something would happen, you know, and he just hasn't had all the luck to actually set the record, even though he has, you know, most of the things to get it done. You just need it all to be in line to, you know, to get it to happen. And then the last couple of years, the weather's been a factor. They drive from New Jersey at the Bonneville for nothing, you know, and they wait a couple of days and drive back. And so that's why you need a lot of time to build a car and run at Bonneville.
Yeah, I'd like to do a car that, because not far from us in Arkansas, they do the standing mile stuff. And you have to build the same car and change a few things and do both with it, which our friends do. So I think it'd be neat to do something like that, do standing mile stuff with it too.
Yeah.
So there's another car. I don't have any notes other than my lead-in stuff. So all this stuff's just popping into my head. One more car I'd like to talk about. Weren't you doing a car that, like, wasn't it a retired GM guy? It was a three-wheeled thing, right?
Yeah.
Are you still working on that?
Yeah. Well, it's not a full car. It's just a fine art piece. It's a quarter-scale model. So Pete Meyer... he was the youngest, and I believe still the youngest to have ever been hired at GM Design. Mm-hmm. So he was still at Pratt at art school in New York in 1964, and he did a project for the 64 World's Fair in New York. And Bill Mitchell hired him on the spot. Well, new guy in the design department. And one of the projects that they gave the newbies, Wheeler. So it was designed to be a single person transportation piece that you would use in the city, you know, just to kind of get around in the city. So he designed this very cool looking for a single driver, and it was going to have a Pontiac single overhead cam engine in it. And the idea was never really to build it. It was just a practice, you know, design study for the new guys. So he designed it, but it got a lot of traction and people still talk about it to this day. And so Pete's a friend of mine. And we always said, we need to make that car, you know, either we make the car or make a fine art piece. So he's a fine art creator now. That's how he makes his living. He does these full size airbrush drawings. And so we recently created a wooden or a clay model. Larry Turk, did the clay modeling. Larry Turk started his career at Ford Motor Company. The first project he ever worked on was the GT40. And the final project he ever worked on, Ford brought him back in to do the clay modeling on the most recent GT that Ford put out. Yeah. Yeah. So he did a clay modeling for us, and we created a body, you know, quarter scale body for Pete Meyer. And then Pete Meyer he'll finish the art piece.
Cool.
But yeah, that's a cool project and just great guys to be working with. You know, these guys are legends and just so cool.
So to wrap this up, without giving away, like sometimes people steal people's ideas. So loosely, is there something that you have not got to be a part of in your career that you like, I would like to do this, or I would like to create this, or build this car, or drive this event, a hill climb, a race, or I mean, because you've even raced at on the beach there too. I'm blank on the name of.
Oh, Trog. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it'd be neat to do a car for that.
Yeah.
Myself, I'd like to do the Great Race.
Yeah.
With, you know, a stock car, I think it would be neat to do that. Just some bucket lists, not work things, just do things. And then
yeah,
we spend so much time in the shop. So like, is there a driving event that you would like to do around the whole world, or a project you'd like to do again without, don't say, oh, I want to design this and somebody might watch this and they steal your idea. So don't give too much, but there's got to be something that Rob Ida as a person that's still in your heart, in your mind. I have one in the back corner of my shop and another one in the barn out back, that things that I've always wanted to do that I'm slowly working on. So what would you like to do that you haven't got to do?
So two things come to mind. One is, I don't know how to surf and I don't know how to ski, but I always thought that it would be very cool to build a car, maybe a Porsche 356. So imagine a Porsche 356 with, you know, skis on the roof rack. And I learn how to ski and I build this car and I get this car to Switzerland and I drive maybe from Italy into Switzerland and I ski with that car there. That would be awesome. Mm-hmm. So it's driving through the country. You know, I love Italy and it'd be great to go into Switzerland and do that and have that whole experience. It would be just for me, you know, obviously it's not a car event. It's just for me. So I would love to do that. And same thing with surfing. So now I live here on the beach and I was learning how to surf a little bit here and there. And I was thinking of building a car. I have a 39 Ford, two-door sedan. You know, it's got a small block and a four-speed and two fours. And I was thinking of learning how to surf here enough that I could put a surfboard on the roof of that thing and drive cross country and surf Atlantic and Pacific and stop along the way. So now we have this Asbury Park circuit, which is this car community, and we can maybe hit other big cruise nights or car events along the way, make our way out to California and surf in the Pacific. Like, that would be awesome.
So I might run into you sometime and just don't question if you're just walking around in a wetsuit, because I know you're training for the surfing
trip, right? Yeah, right.
So don't judge me. I'm in
that's what it's about.
In my wetsuit. So,
because right now I only know how to work on cars. I've never skied or surfed or anything like that before.
Yeah, we have the skateboard as a kid. I wasn't very good on it because I lived in the country. We still BMX race. We were a couple weeks ago. We were in Louisiana BMX race, and that's our thing that we still do, trying to pretend that we're not old as hell.
But I like how you like incorporate what you want to do with cars, because we do the same thing with BMX. Yeah. It's like, oh, it would be really cool to have this vehicle because we could deck it out with BMX stuff. Yeah. So it's like,
I
like
which we use that on a lot of the SEMA dollar vehicles. We did a lot of BMX themed stuff, so it was easy to get help and exposure because we were taking it to all these BMX events. So yeah, we've done that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I love to learn like other things and incorporate that for my love of cars. But, you know, I'm imagining if I'm in Italy, I love food and I would, you know, probably, you know, want to find all these special places, and I love history and I'd want to see all these old churches and things like that, that, you know, I've only read about. I would like to, you know, experience that and do that, you know, with a car, you know. So.
And now, I mean, you've always been a family man and your girls have always been number one and important. And
he's a grandpa now. But now he's a grandpa.
So now you have to
pass
the tradition on to your granddaughter. Right.
Yeah. So Brenda and I just spent the whole weekend, right up until, you know, 7 o'clock, watching our granddaughter, because our daughter was at work today. So a little Violet, she's 9 months old. And so we're loving that. And, you know, that's great. They live right here too by the beach. So that's been a nice addition.
We know them a little bit because they both went on the cruise, didn't they?
Yeah. So my one daughter was sick. She had a high fever during the cruise. So you hardly saw her.
She kind of thought I was an idiot, which who can blame her?
No, she had a high fever.
Yeah. But they're not really into cars, are they?
Not really. No, no, they're not really into cars.
Yeah, that's kind of sad that a lot of people, their generation, but maybe the grandkid will be in the cars or something, but you never,
well,
you
never know. Another girl, but yeah. You know, I have young guys in the shop, so I've always had, you know, either interns or young employees, and you know, a lot of times these guys, you know, didn't have access to these cars. You know, maybe their father wasn't into cars, you know, and usually that's kind of the way. All the guys in my place, or that have been in my place, really didn't have that. So I do feel like it gets passed on, you know, just maybe not to my kids, but it does get passed on to other people who do good things with it.
And I've met Artie that's worked there. Was Artie still there with you?
Well, so I have two Arties. So the first Artie, who was with me for, you know, 15 years or whatever, he started his own shop a couple of years ago nearby, and he's doing well. And now he has a son, and so he's doing great. And then the other Artie, he was an intern with me in 2018, and he's been full-time with me now for about, you know, since, I guess, about 5 years. And he's learned, you know, everything in the shop, metal shaping.
Who's your painter guy?
Russ. Yep. Yeah. Actually, I'm painting again. Russ went back to his own business, so he's doing that now. So I'm back in the spray booth, too. But yeah, I mean, all these guys are great guys, and they, you know, so I feel like it does get passed on.
Yeah, just me. I got to know some of your guys that we just mentioned, and they're not just, well, I think they're kind of cool because they're really cool dudes. And like Russ, not only is he an awesome paint and body guy, but he's part of a Nitro Nostalgia car. He plays in a rockabilly band. All these guys are like, they live life like you do. So I think that's kind of cool that they're not just, I mean, we spend so much time, but I like to see people doing other things. Like we always say, tomorrow's not promised. So that's why I do the bike stuff. And I do have a guitar in here, but I don't ever have time to try to figure out how to learn it. And that's one thing. Yeah. That's one thing that I would like to try to do is learn how to play. You know, a punk rock guy, you only need to know 3 chords and then a distortion pedal.
Yeah.
Yeah. She thinks she wants to be a country music singer, but
yeah,
it's not working well. It sounds like somebody stepped on the cat's tail usually. Which our cats have not. We keep
looking
around.
They've been in here. Like, that's why we've been doing
that. Usually we have a cat walks around on, you know, walks in front of the screen, but they have not made an appearance right now. So I want to wrap this up. Where does everybody find you online, or your social media, Instagram, Facebook pages? Where can they find Rob Ida?
Yeah, best way is my Instagram. That's the thing I probably keep updated because it's just so easy to do. So my Instagram is Rob_Ida. And, you know, we're on Facebook too, but really Instagram is probably, you know, where you're going to see the most content.
Mm-hmm. Or at the beach.
Or at the beach.
Or at the beach.
Yeah. So we want to thank you, Rob. Yeah. It's an honor to call you and Brenda friends in our life.
Thank you.
Great people came in our life because of cars, and we consider the Idas right up there at the top of the list. You're great people. We even talk about, Rob was one of the guys I suckered in to come and spend a week for free and was on my TV show. We built a Hudson together. And he
that
brought,
was an awesome experience.
And he brought the Tucker twins' grandsons. Their grandsons or great-grandsons?
They're great-grandsons. Yeah.
So they came on. He brought them, and I met Adam Harder through you, which I you know, stay in touch with Adam. So, it's been great having you in our lives. We enjoyed the trip that we took on that. But we need to come visit the Idas and spend some time on the beach.
You do, yeah. Well, when you come here, you could spend some time on the beach. We're New York City's right up the street here, so we spend a lot of time there, too. So we can show you guys around. And unfortunately, you missed Englishtown, right? You've never been to Englishtown Raceway Park, the drag strip. Yeah, so it's gone now, unfortunately.
No, it's a junkyard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, they do have a track, though. It's just for drifting. So they do drifting events there. So it's still active, but it's not a drag strip.
Awesome. Okay, anything you want to thank, plug, a sponsor, or company, or...
No, but I want to thank you guys because you're always kind of looking out for me and remembering me because I'm not out there all the time. So thank you for that. I do appreciate it.
Make sure you thank your wife. Thank Brenda. Hopefully she's in the background teasing her hair up for me. And congratulations on being inducted in the National Rod and Custom Car Hall of Fame.
Thank you. Thanks.
So very well deserved. You've done great things, and we all know you're not done yet. So thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much. Have a good night.
We'll see you later.
You too.
The Strange Motion Way podcast, brought to you by Royal Purple Synthetic Oils.
Royal Purple premium synthetic motor oils and high-performance chemicals have been designed to improve performance in all conditions and provide cleaner operation, better mileage, and decreased oil change frequency. That means less oil changes. With products available for your gasoline and diesel engines, Royal Purple is the obvious choice for your performance needs. Drive with Royal Purple, the synthetic expert.
And that was another great episode of the Strange Motion Way podcast. Had a little bit of internet problems in there a couple times, but hopefully it'll be okay.
Yeah, we had to switch over to Zoom, a different format than what we're used to using, but we still got the point across.
And I'm sure we're going to have Rob Ida back at another time. Next week, are you ready for this one, Carrie?
I don't know if I am or not.
This was either the first or second one we ever recorded. Again, not very good internet. We were still learning sound. My dad, Dan Strange. It's not about where I came from. It's about his life. Of course, he inspired me with his Harleys and his Tri-Fives and his hot rods and his work ethic. He came from a very crappy childhood. It's hard to get him to talk about it, but we did. So we got my dad for about an hour coming up next week.
Stay tuned.
Is your mom making an appearance still on that cut?
My mom is a little, and she's in the background.
Yeah. Carrie's mom does not drink, no matter what she sounds like.